First Chronicles 22.
Let's just kind of do a little bit of a review. First Samuel is primarily about who? First Samuel.
That's Saul.
It's mostly about Saul. Second Samuel is mostly about
David.
First Kings is mostly about
Solomon.
Okay, it starts out with Solomon and then it gets all the other ones. The Chronicles, First Chronicles is kind of about David. First Chronicles is somewhat quite a bit like Second Samuel. It covers a lot of the same territory. So the Chronicles are the same things in a different version, so to speak. What it was is that the kings would write down. You know, they had their scribes that would write down, take diary notes of what's going on in the kingdom. That's kind of what the Chronicles were. And so the Chronicles were kind of the diary notes of the kings as to what was going on in the kingdom. And that's why there's a lot of parallels between the Samuels and the Chronicles. Because they over in the kings. They all kind of overlap each other, but they're not all exactly alike. But in here in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, we find one event that's take place in the late part of David's life, just before he dies. He has a desire to build a temple. And God told him no. He couldn't build a temple, and we're going to see why as we look into our passage here tonight. But God told him no, but he said that you can prepare for the temple. And so David began to prepare things to build the temple. And Solomon was going to be able to build the temple later on. After David was off the scene, Solomon would build the temple. But David was preparing it. And as David prepared it, he did so in a way, he had these plans in his mind. And I don't know whether God gave David the plans for the temple, or whether he gave them to Solomon, or maybe to both. But David knew in his mind what he envisioned the temple to look like. It was a grand, big, beautiful building. And you think about it, in the days that they lived in, most of them lived in either tents or in small little houses that were built of stones and mud, mud bricks and stones, and they would build them up into just a small little modest house, and didn't have hardly any windows in it, and usually have a flat roof on the top. And some of them lived in the nicer buildings that would have more of a brick type of a building. But many of the people that lived out in the villages just lived in very simple dwellings. And so for them to build a temple that was actually, it would be a magnificent building today. It was big. It was big, and it was just phenomenally built. And it was beautiful and costly. And the stones in it, some of the stones they say that were in the bottom of the temple were gigantic, huge stones. And the stones that today we would have a difficult time moving. And yet they knew how to move stuff like that. And so there was a lot of things that were it was unique. And it was a beautiful, big building. And so David had all these plans that he was going through his mind, and he wanted to do this because he loved God. You know, you look at David's writings, and David didn't write all of the Psalms, but David wrote a lot of the Psalms. And in the Psalms, you see a lot of David's feelings being expressed about God. And you read verses like Psalm 29, verse 2, says, "Give unto the Lord the glory, do unto his name, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness." Think about that verse. Give unto the Lord the glory, do unto his name, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. We also find in Psalm 99, verse 5, "Exalt ye the Lord our God, and worship at his footstool, for he is holy." David is saying here, our God is awesome. Our God is holy. Our God is great. And I wish I had the time tonight to just spend on just looking at God and who God is. Maybe I'll do that in the next few weeks. I've been thinking about that. And talking about the character, the awesomeness of God, the grandeur of God, the greatness of God. But David could see this, and in his heart, he pictured God as the great and awesome God of the universe. And he said, I want everybody in the world to know that our God is a great and awesome God. And he says, in order to do that, I want to build a temple that will reflect his glory. Now, the glory of God, the word glory refers to something that shines. It refers to something that gives praise to. It's the that which, you know, just is hard to describe, the beauty and the awesomeness of something. And he says, I want the world to be able to see the glory of God and the honor that we give to God. And how that we need to worship Him in holiness. And He wanted the world to be able to get a glimpse of this through the temple. He said, I want this temple to be such an awesome building that everybody that sees it will say, they got an awesome God. They got an awesome God. Because the pagans would build temples. There was a temple in not in this day, but later on in Paul's day in Ephesus, the temple of Diana. It was a gigantic and beautiful building that was built for Diana, the false gods. And David was saying, I don't want there to be any rivals. I want this building to be a building that will shine for our God and let people see what our God is like. And we're going to see that as we work our way through this chapter today and then make some personal applications as to the temple today and how it ought to shine for God. Okay, so as we begin, notice first of all that David gathered the materials. Verse 1, it says, and David said, this is the house of the Lord. Let's stop at that phrase first of all. Chapter 21 ends the same record of the event when there was the plague in the land and David went to floor of Ornan, threshing floor of Ornan, built an altar there, and sacrificed to the Lord. And while he was there, he's still there, the very next chapter, remember in the Bible originally, it didn't have chapter divisions, so the first verse of 22, it says, and David said, this is the house of the Lord God. He somehow, maybe prophetically, somehow he sensed that this is where God wanted them to meet. Because remember, who told him to go to the floor of Ornan? God did. God says, you go to the floor of Ornan and buy that floor from him and build an altar there and worship me there and I will stop the plague. And he did that. And David now recognizes that this is something special. And as far as we can understand, that was exactly where they built the temple. That was where they built the temple. On that threshing floor of Ornan. That flat plateau there in the hill of Jerusalem. And so He says that, and we continue on, and it says, and this is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel. And David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel, and he set masons to hew wrought stones to build the house of God. And David prepared iron in abundance for nails and for the doors of the gates and for the joinings, and brass in abundance without weight. Also cedars in abundance for the Zidonians. And they of Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. All right, now let's stop and think about these. He's gathering materials for the temple. And did you notice there, when you see something that seems odd, stop and think on it. Verse number 2, let me read it again and see if you can see anything odd there. It says, and David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel, and he set masons to hew wrought stones and to build the house of God. What's odd about that verse? It says there that David found all the strangers in the land. What's it talking about? The strangers. Well, the strangers were people who were not Jews. And what strangers would there be in the land? Well, there's two different kinds of people that would be in the land that weren't Jews. One would have been, remember, way back in years before, in Joshua's day, Joshua didn't fulfill all that was supposed to be, and they didn't get rid of all of the Canaanites that were in the land. They got most of them out, but there was still a few pockets here and there that weren't destroyed and run out of the land. And remember, they caused problems during the days of the judges, and there was all kinds of problems because they hadn't gotten rid of all of the Canaanites. So there's a few of those. Maybe it was some of those that David gathers them up. They're the strangers in the land. He's going to make them slaves to do his work. But then also, when they had conquered cities and conquered other lands, when they were in battles, they would bring back people as slaves that were part of the the booty they would get from their captures of various cities. And so all these people worked as slaves. And so David gathered all the slaves together, all the non-Jews together, and he says, all right, we've got a job for all these folk. They're going to work for us. They're going to cut stones, and they're going to cut timber, and they're going to smelt the metals, the iron to make nails, and they're going to smelt the brass and the silver and the gold, and they're going to melt that. That was hard work. All that kind of work was hard work. You know, getting in those furnaces where they'd get the blowers going on to get the fire hot enough to melt the gold and the silver and the brass and the iron. It was not a pleasant job. Even to this day, people that work in foundries and things of that nature where they have to heat that metal super hot in order to melt it. That's not a very pleasant job. That's a hot and miserable job. And so David said, we're going to have all the strangers do that. We're not going to make our people do that. We'll have the old slaves do that. And so he's got the slaves out there working to gather up all these things, cut all these stones and the timber, and smelt all this metal to make it into the instruments and tools that they needed for building the temple. And so he's gathering all this. And notice there he says that they got cedars from Tyre. All right, now think with me again. Where in Israel, or where in the location, were the Zidonians and Tyre and Sidon? Where were they? They were up in the north. All right, remember, if you look at a map again, you got the Mediterranean Sea there, the Dead Sea down here, Jordan River going up there, Galilee here. All right, up here is Tyre and Sidon. All right, along the shores, Tyre and Sidon, way up there. Jerusalem's down here. All right, so what they would do, they'd get that cedar, and they would get the big cedar trees that grew up here in Lebanon, and get them out in the ocean. They'd bring them down by the ship in the ocean, get down to Caesarea, and then they would travel them across over to Jerusalem on land. And so that's where Tyre and Sidon was. And so he says here that they brought down an abundance of cedar trees from Tyre and Sidon. And it brought him down. So David is preparing. He's making all his preparations. And he planned for the temple's appearance. He wanted it to picture God's excellence. Now, if we were going to do something to try to picture God's excellence, how would we go about that? You know, one of the things that would happen is, first of all, we'd have to ask ourselves, how much do I know about God in His excellence to be able to describe it? You know, what David was trying to do is describe it in a material form, something that would show God is an excellent, awesome, fantastic, wonderful God, worth spending all their money on. I mean, this temple would have cost them, in our day, would have cost them millions and millions and millions because of all the gold and the silver and things that were in it, and all the specially cut stones and carrying it all down. It was a very elaborate, expensive building. And David's in the preparation for this because he wants people to see the excellence of God. Look at verse number 5. And David said, Solomon, my son, is young and tender. The house that is to be built for the Lord must be exceeding magnificent, of fame and of glory throughout all countries. I will therefore now make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly before his death. He says there that he wanted it to be exceedingly magnificent. Now those words mean great beyond the highest extreme. Great to the greatest extreme. He said, I want this to be the greatest, most beautiful, most wonderful building that's ever been built. That was his idea. Why did he want that? Was David wanting this so that everybody would look back at him and say, whoa, David was an awesome king. Look at that beautiful building he built. That wasn't why, because he wasn't even going to build it. His son was going to build it. It was because he wanted everybody to see what God was like. He said there again in verse 5 in the middle, he says that it should be built for the Lord. It was to be built for the Lord. And it was both to be great in fame and in glory. The word fame there deals with the reputation, what people thought of it. It was to be great in its fame, but it was also to be great in its glory. The glory there, speaking of its splendor, the beauty of it. So he says, I want it both to be well known as a wonderful, awesome work representing our great God, and I also want it to bring glory and honor to God. I want it to be beautiful so that every country, all nations. Notice there he says that in all countries, news would spread about this temple. And people would say, that temple. Whoa, you ought to see that temple in Jerusalem. That is awesome. That temple in Jerusalem, they did that because of their great God. The God of Israel is an awesome God. You should see that temple. It was beautiful. It was big. It was gold. It was expensive. It was beautiful. It was awesome because they got a great and awesome God. And so that's what David wanted everyone in the world to see. He wanted them to see God's greatness. Now, we note also that David said that the house was for the Lord. Verse 6 again. It says that they were to build a house for the Lord God of Israel. Then look at verse number 7. Verse 7 says, and David said to Solomon, my son, as for me, it was in my mind to build a house unto the name of the Lord my God. To build a house unto the name of the Lord my God. He said, I want to build it so that it honors his name. So that everybody that sees it would say, God is great. Look at their God. See what their God did. And so everything he was doing about this temple, he said, the whole temple, it needs to be such a way that everyone who sees it just says, they've got a great God. They've got a great God. And he goes on in verse number 10. Again, he says in verse 10, he shall build an house for my name. All right, now God's speaking here about Solomon, and he says, God says, I want Solomon to build a house for my name. For my name. David wasn't to build a house for his name. Solomon wasn't to build a house for his name. You know, when we do things, many times we do it for our name. So people would say, whoa, look at what they did. They did something cool. They did something really nice. And we end up getting puffed up over it. David said, and God said too, I don't want you to build it for your name. I want you to build it for my name. It is to honor me. It is everything about it is to lift up me. And you know, God, sometimes we think of God and think, well, why is it wrong for us to want have some pride issues of look what I did, and it's right for God, but it's wrong for me. Why is that? Well, the reason is because everything we have came from God. We're nothing. I mean, the skills that we may have, they came from God. The intelligence we have came from God. The abilities we have came from God. Our body that we use to do the things that we do all came from God. And God, on the other hand, is the Jehovah, the self-existent one. Everything he does is because of him. Everything he does is, he is the source of it. He is the root of it. He is the cause of it. He is the design of it. He is the ultimate. And it is not prideful for him to say, look what I have done. Look what I am. Exalt me because of who I am, because he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He is the greatest of all beings that ever existed and ever will exist. Whereas we are just created beings. And when we start getting ourselves puffed up, then we're taking God off of the throne. We're robbing from God. And so he said, I don't want this to be built for David's name. I don't want it to be built for Solomon's name. I want it to be built for my name. And so David was preparing to make this place a place of honor and reputation and beauty for God's name. So everything he was doing was focused on, I want this to please God. I want God to be lifted up. I want God to be praised. I want God to be seen as a great and awesome God. Now, what can we learn from this? You know, every time we read a scripture, we need to ask ourselves, what can we benefit? How can we learn from this? Well, one of the things that comes to our mind immediately is then, does that mean that we ought to build a church building that looks awesome? And it would seem like on the outside that that's probably a good application. But what we need to do is we need to sift everything we do through the scriptures. All right? Think with me now. Just put on your thinker and let's think. In the Old Testament, where did God live? I mean, he kind of lived there. Okay, he lived in the tabernacle or the temple. Right? Now, God wasn't only there, but God said, I will come down and I will abide on the altar, the Ark of the Covenant, on the top of the Ark of the Covenant, underneath the cherubims on the Ark of the Covenant. God said, that's where I'll be. And the Ark of the Covenant was supposed to be in the Holy of Holies of the temple or the tabernacle. And God was outside of that as well, but that's kind of where he was. And when they wanted to come to meet God and they wanted to come to worship God, where did they go? They went to the tabernacle or the temple. They would offer sacrifices at the tabernacle or the temple. They would come to pray at the tabernacle or at the temple. When Daniel prayed, he prayed toward the Jerusalem and toward the temple because God dwelt there. All right? And so in the Old Testament, they worshiped toward the temple. They didn't worship the temple. They worshiped the God in the temple because that's where God would dwell. After Christ rose from the dead and returned to heaven, where does God dwell? He indwells inside of us. We are now his temple. And so a building, whether it be this building or any building that we would someday build, is not where God dwells. And I think that we ought to have a church building that looks nice. If we were ready to build a church building, I'm not saying throw up some kind of a shack down the street and everybody will look at it and think, whoa, what's that thing? You know, that's, you know, an old tool shed that they're meeting in. And if that's all we could afford, then fine. I know some churches, I remember years and years and years ago, when we were raising support to go to Papua New Guinea, one of the churches we went to was in the heart of Chicago. And it was right in the very, very dangerous area. In fact, I was standing outside of the church talking to the preacher, and he says, see that man walking down the street up there in the corner? He says, he's the head of the mafia in this area here. Yeah, I mean, they were right in the ghetto, right in the very dangerous area. And their church building looked shabby on the outside. It was just a normal old building like all the rest of the buildings on the street. But in the inside, they had it fixed up really nice. And they did that on purpose because if you make it fancy on the outside, people are going to think, hey, this place has got some money inside and they're going to break into it. So they made it so that it didn't look valuable on the outside. And most of the troublemakers didn't go in, so they never knew what was on the inside. It just looked like a shabby old building on the outside. But they made the inside nice. Now, I'm not saying that we should build a shabby looking building. And I don't think but that's not where God dwells. That's where we meet for worship. That's where we meet. And when we meet together as Christians, our temples come together. The Spirit of God is with us. And we are there and God is present with us. And so, but the thing that we see here is then in the Old Testament, God dwelt in the temple that was there in Jerusalem or the tabernacle. Now he dwells in us. The Spirit of God dwells in me. The Spirit of God dwells in you. And as we think about that, we need to ask ourselves some questions. How does God want us to take care of our tabernacle, our temple? We read over in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Why don't you flip over there? If you can't, don't lose your spot. We'll be back here where we are. But 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and look at verse number 19. 1 Corinthians 6 and look at verse number 19. 1 Corinthians 6 verse 19 says what? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own, for ye are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So what did Paul say here? He said, your body is the temple of God. You are the temple of God. And he says, you need to glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Glorify him through in your body. And so he's making the application for us in the New Testament that we are God's temple. The Old Testament was God had a building that he dwelt in. Now God dwells in us. That is awesome. Because in the Old Testament, when they wanted to worship God, they had to go to the temple. When we want to worship God, all we got to do is get on our knees. Because God's right there with us already. I mean, God's here all the time. And we can be with, he is with us all the time. We have that personal communication with him. We can talk to him anytime. We can pray anytime. We can worship him anytime. We can praise him anytime. And he's always with us. And that is a great privilege. And as a result, as we think about how David was acting, he said, I want everybody to see the greatness of God in the temple. And I believe that the application here is that we ought to say, I want others to see the greatness of God in me. I want others to see Christ in me. I want others to be able to see Jesus in me. And you know, when you see people, when people see you, I should say, when people see you, do they see Jesus? That should affect every area of our life. It should affect the way that we act. It should affect the way that we talk. It should affect the way that we respond to situations. It should affect our attitudes. It should affect our the things that we do, the places that we go, the things that we listen to, the things that we watch. It should affect our clothing. It should affect the way that we care for our bodies. You know, it isn't just a personal preference. Whether you, for example, I'll just use this as an example. Years ago, there was a man that I knew that was, he said that he was a Christian, and I hope he was. God knows, I don't know. But he's gone now. And he always looked like a tramp. All right? His clothes were always hanging out. He was always sloppy and nothing was ever ironed, and his hair was always a mess, and he always had a scruffy looking, you know, face. And I mean, that's the way he was. He just looked unkempt. He looked like he didn't care about himself. Nothing wrong with a beard, as long as he takes care of it. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with beard, but his beard was kind of all over the place, and he never trimmed it, never took care of it. And so God, as he went around and people saw him, I asked myself, did people look at him and say, I see Jesus in him. He reminds me of Jesus. I don't think so. He never reminded me of Jesus, put it that way. Right. And once people see us, what do they see in you? What do they see in me? If they followed us around all day tomorrow, what would they see in us? Would they see the way we combed our hair, kept ourselves looking nice, and were neat and trim and proper, and our mouth was guarded, and our attitude was right, and we responded right? I mean, keeping our temple right is a lot of work. David spent a lot of work preparing. It was a lot of work preparing. And you know, we have a lot of work to keep our temple looking right and acting right and being right. It's not easy. I struggle with that. And I think you probably struggle with it too. It is a job that is not easy, and we need to work at it diligently. But you know, it's something that all of us can do. It's not something that's impossible. It's not something that's able for us to do. We can do it if we'll put our hearts and minds into it to care for ourselves. Remember, people look at me. You know, that's true about you young people as well. Doesn't matter whether you're young or old. People are watching you. They know whether you call yourself a Christian or not. And if you look like you don't represent Christ by your actions, your attitudes, your dress, the way that you carry yourself, the way that you respond, the things that you do, if that tells people that I'm just like everybody else, then they don't see Jesus in us. There needs to be something about us that stands out, special, and that people would see and say, there's something about them. You know, I may have mentioned this in the past, but when we were, I don't know, one of our travels, I think we were in Los Angeles. We're in the airport. And we saw a family. And I just saw them. I'd never met them in my life, but I told Melody, I said, it was a Christian family. You could tell by the looks. You could tell by the way the kids were behaving. You could tell by the way they were dressed. The ladies were all in dresses and looked nice. The boys were all dressed decently and looked decent. They all act prim and proper. They were all just, I mean, they didn't look like culty type people. They looked like Christians. And, you know, that's what I want people to say when they see me, that they never saw me before. Say, there's something different about that guy. I wonder if he's a Christian. You know, that ought to be what people see when they see us. They ought to be able to say, there's something about them that look like a Christian. And our lives ought to shine for Christ. Our words, our actions, our attitudes. You know, we often struggle with the area of clothing. And, you know, this is because the world is so against godliness. This world is so pagan. Really is in every aspect. But you know, as we think about this, I want to, from a fatherly perspective, I want to just give you some tips that will help us to keep in mind, that help us in these areas. You know, men, one of the things that we need to be careful about, short shorts and running around without a shirt on. I mean, sometimes people say, well, what difference does it make? You know, the girls aren't going to get turned on by me. Look at me. I'm just fat and plebby, and it's just on me. Well, that's not the point. We're representing Jesus. We're representing Jesus. And when people see us, they need to be able to see that and think, I see Jesus in him. And the, you know, things like body piercings and tattoos and things of that nature. You know, I'm so glad that none of you are into that kind of thing. But you know, as I see people, just today I saw a guy walking down the street and it looked like he had dark clothes on. But it wasn't. It was all covered with tattoos. The poor fella. And I'm thinking, what would happen if the guy got saved? He's got to live with that the rest of his life. What he's done to his body. And they pierce their body all over the place and put all these studs in all kinds of weird places and tattoo themselves. And they do that because the world thinks it's cool. But that doesn't picture Jesus. It doesn't help the world see Jesus in us. And we need to ask ourselves, what's going to help the world see Jesus in me? And things like over in 1 Corinthians 11, it talks about long hair on men, how that's a shame to the man, and how short hair on a woman is a shame to her, and it's her long hair is her glory. See, that's God saying, represent Jesus. Let the world see Jesus in you, in the way that you act, in the way that you dress. And ladies, when you know, if you wear pants and jeans or shorts or leggings and these kind of things, it's all part of the unisex movement. The devil's using that to try to get everybody to look alike. Let's not look different. Let's look alike. Breaking down the genders and trying to get the genders to merge and mix. I never thought I would see what we've seen in our day, where the world is now putting their stamp of approval on and insisting on us joining them in approving the unisex movement and the homosexual movement. It's kind of scary. And I'm afraid it's going to lead to severe persecution for Christians because of the world's emphasis on that. And I think as Christians, we need to stand out and be different and be separate from this. And where, you know, even wearing short skirts and things of that nature, even if there's leggings under it, it still causes men to take a second look. And you don't want that. That's not the kind of thing that we want people to do. We want to stand out as distinctly Christ-like. So people look at us and say, there's something different about them. What is that? There's something unique about them. And that's what we want people to see in us. We want to have them see Christ in us. And to avoid things that would hinder that. And you know, young people, the time to determine in your heart what you're going to be for Christ and how you're going to dress is at your age. I know my wife, as a young teenage girl, made some very critical decisions in her life as she sat under the preaching and preachers taught about dress and modesty and things. And that's when she developed those convictions in her life. It wasn't when she met me. She had those convictions far before she met me. And, you know, that's the time to settle them in your heart when you're young and say, this is what I'm going to be, this is how I'm going to dress, this is how I'm going to act, this is what I'm going to do, this is the kind of life I'm going to have. I want people to see Jesus in me. And determine in your heart, you're going to be that kind of a person. And then David goes on and he charges Solomon to build the temple, verses 6 to 10. He gives him a charge, and in verse 6 it says, and he called for Solomon, his son, and he charged him to build the house of the Lord, God of Israel. And David said to Solomon, my son, as for me, it was in my mind to build the house unto the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born of thee, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies round about, and for his name shall be Solomon. And I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. And he shall build an house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Now, my son, the Lord be with thee, and prosper thou and build the house of the Lord thy God, as he hath said of thee. All right, so here David is encouraging him. In the next verse, it says, only the Lord give thee wisdom and understanding, and give thee charge concerning Israel, that thou mayest keep the law of the Lord thy God. Then shalt thou prosper if thou takest heed to fulfill the statutes and judgments of the Lord, which the Lord charged Moses with concerning Israel. Be strong and of good courage. Dread not, nor be dismayed. Now, David says, son, you got a big job ahead of you. It's not going to be easy to build that temple. It is going to be a big task. It is a huge undertaking. And you're going to need God's wisdom. You're going to need God's understanding. You need God's help. And so he's urging him to take that into consideration. You know, knowing exactly how to best glorify God in our bodies, we need God's wisdom. We need God's understanding. We need to pray and say, God, give me understanding and wisdom. How can I best show the world your awesome greatness by the way I look and the way I act and the things I do and my character? I want the world to see Jesus in me. How can I do that? We need to ask God for help. And we need to stay close to God, as he said there in verse 13. You need to stay close to him. And, you know, it is sad that as you look around, and I've been in a lot of churches, far more than any of you have ever been in. I've been in hundreds of churches, independent Baptist churches, almost all of them are independent Baptist churches. And it's sad that we live in a world today where many of the Christians in good churches do not picture Jesus. You look at their life and you say, I don't see Jesus in them. I don't see much of Jesus in them. And that's sad. It shouldn't be that way. It should be that everybody we're around, we say, boy, they're an awesome person. Look at that person's character, the way that they live, the way that they act. Their character is great, and they're just an awesome person to be around because they remind me of Jesus. And that ought to be said in our lives. And I tell you that to help you to see that we cannot just look at others around us and say, well, everybody else is doing this. That's not the point. We don't want to pattern our lives after everybody else. We want to pattern our lives in a way that brings glory and honor to God. And our body is that temple that needs to glorify God. And that needs to be our passion. If we, in our hearts tonight, if each of us said, my passion in life is I want my life, every part of it, to glorify God. I want my character to glorify God. I want my actions to glorify God. I want my mouth to glorify God. I want my appearance to glorify God. I want to take care of myself and look nice so that I'm glorifying God all the time with everything I do. I want everything about my life to shine for Him so that people would see Christ in me. That needs to be a passion of our heart, to reflect the holiness and glory of God. And then David closes the chapter, verses 17 and 19, by commanding the people of Israel to help him. David also commanded all the princes of Israel to help Solomon, his son, saying, is not the Lord your God with you? And hath he not given you rest on every side? For he hath given the inhabitants of the land into mine hand, and the land is subdued before the Lord and before his people. Now set your heart and your soul to seek the Lord your God. Arise, therefore, and build you the sanctuary of the Lord God, to bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and the holy vessels of God into the house that is to be built to the name of the Lord. Now, several things here. He says, I want you folks, the rest of you, the people of Israel, I want you to help Solomon with this big task. It's going to take work. He's young. He needs help. He needs your strength. But notice the key thing. I think this is the key of the whole chapter. Verse number 19. He says, set your heart and your soul to seek the Lord your God. You know, if we're going to make it our goal and our passion to glorify God with our life, so that everybody that sees us would say, I see Jesus in them. Their attitude, their actions, the way they act, the way they respond, the way they treat their family, the way that they care for things, their property, the way that they do everything. Everything about them tells me that something's unique about them. They know Jesus. If we're going to have that, we need to have this as the key of our life. Set your heart and your soul to seek the Lord your God. It's got to be from the heart. You know, if what we talked about here tonight, if you go away and say, yeah, pastor's on me again, I got to do what pastor wants me to do, because if I don't, then pastor's going to think I'm something bad. If that's the attitude you have, it'll never work. It'll never work. But if you go away and saying, I've got a passion. I want to please God. I want more than anything in my whole life to please God. With my whole heart, I have my heart set on seeking God and pleasing God. I want God to be pleased with me, and I want everybody to see Jesus in me. Then it'll change your life. It'll change your life. These things that seem difficult will be easy. The things that the God will make it easier for us to do, the things that seem so complicated and so frustrating to us, will say, hey, if that's my goal, my passion, my desire, God will help us to do what's right. And he reminds us here that we need help. You know, having a godly pastor, a pastor's wife, a teacher, or your parents, great help to you to be able to help you to go the right trail, to go the right direction, to follow the right way, and to be able to say, I want to please God with all of my life. That's my passion. Reminds me of what David said when he said, as a hart panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My heart panteth after you, O God. And I close with Proverbs 15:32. God commends those who compliments those who accept godly help. Proverbs 15:32 says, and he that refuseth instruction despiseth his own soul, but he that heareth reproof getteth understanding. God says, if we listen to reproof, whether it be your parents or another godly leader that is trying to help you and lead you in the right direction, if we listen and say, I want to follow it. I want to follow it right. God said, I'll bless you. I'll bless you. And so tonight, my challenge is that you would just ask God, God, help me to take care of my temple in a way that would honor and glorify and praise you. And lift up your name so when people see me, they see Jesus in me.